Hello, this time on Sit Rep, how much money is enough for defence? Donald Trump says it should be more than double what we spend right now. Lithuania and Estonia say they'll meet his 5% target, but the UK's still not even set out a path to 2.5%.
There are people on the government benches that want faster, stronger movement on this. I think that's politically important that there's people on the Labour side of the House of Commons making some polite political noise.
We'll hear more from Labour MP Luke Akehurst and do some reality checking with Mike. President Trump has promised to spend big on an Iron Dome-style missile shield to protect the US from hypersonic weapons. Is it possible? And should the UK be thinking along the same lines? And amid a right royal row, we explain who really chooses the names of Royal Navy vessels and how.
Sit Rep
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
If you go back to 1985, 40 years ago, would you believe, we spent 5.2% of our national income, that's GDP, on defence. When you look at it that way, maybe Donald Trump's latest demand of NATO allies doesn't seem so ridiculous.
No, it doesn't. I mean, and even at the end of the Cold War, say 1991, 92, we were spending 4% on defence. And when the Cold War was at its peak, we were spending about 7%. Of our GDP on defence in the 60s and early 70s. So, you know, these numbers are not unusual historically. And as the Americans keep saying to the Europeans, we only do whole numbers. We don't do fractions. We do 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%. And 5% is a lot of money, and it would be double what we're now spending on it. But we shouldn't be frightened of that in historical terms, because if we're on the road towards a war, which at the moment we are, it's not inevitable, but that is the road that we are presently on, then we're going to have to start spending those sort of amounts pretty quickly.
A reality check, though, Mike, even though the US currently spends 3.4% of its GDP on defence, and that buys it the world's most powerful military, so notionally, if you ignore all the financial constraints, how much would be enough for us to spend?
Well, we've got to make up the slack, as it were, after over a decade of rundown, and that is like a hole that you just got to keep putting money into before things start to get better. And remember, too, the government is saying they're going for growth. I mean, if your GDP grows, then 3% of a bigger GDP is worth a great deal more money. 4% is worth even more. So there is a balance to be struck between just throwing money into defence and actually going for growth. But we haven't got the time to get it wrong. We used to think we had until the 2030s, at least, until we had to get back towards conventional warfare, but we don't. We've got to consider conventional warfare now in the mid-2020s. That's the problem.
And if we were to spend 5% of GDP on defence eventually, could we really spend it usefully?
Good question. As I say, that you wouldn't see the first part of it, because it's got to go to make up the deficiencies, but you'd see it after that. I mean, I think the best way to understand it is, if you put it in cash terms, people get very confused by defence expenditure. And I always think, give it a back of an envelope sort of calculation. So our GDP, Britain's GDP, is about £2.5 trillion. That is our GDP, 2,500 billion. So 2.5% of that is about 60 billion, which is about what we're spending at the moment on defence, roughly. If we spent 5%, then 5% would be 125 billion on defence instead of 60 billion. So effectively, we'd be doubling it. Each 1% on the defence budget is worth about 25 billion pounds in terms of our current GDP. So think of it in those terms. You know, we've got a GDP of 2,500 billion, 2,500 billion. So what's 1% of that, 3% of that, 5% of that? You can do it yourself on the back of an envelope, and I'll check it out. Those figures do more or less work.
So, Mike, whatever Donald Trump wants, 5% isn't on the table in the UK right now. And the question is, when we grow from our current level of 2.3% to 2.5%, how much of a difference would that really make to our military capability?
Not very much in the first instance. for the reasons that we've just discussed. But we've got to do something about this these deficiencies. We've got to make good the deficiencies in numbers and make sure that more of our force is deployable. So we've got too many ships that are not at sea for all sorts of reasons. We've got too many aircraft which are not available and too few pilots to fly them. We've got too few armoured vehicles. The ones we've got are pretty good, but there's just not enough of them. So we've got to make good those deficiencies, even though we've also got to get into the issues of new warfare and missile defence, maybe, and certainly new ways of using artificial intelligence and embracing the new battlefield. So it's a real problem of making up some of the deficiencies as well as keeping up to date. And that's why when the Defence Review appears, all of us expect it to, as it were, require some pretty severe trade-offs. When we see it, you know, it won't be surprising if the trade-offs really are quite painful.
And from the outside, it might look odd to think we're going to have to spend billions more just largely to stand still.
Yes, and that's the result of a decade or more of rundown. That's the point. You can keep making economies and keep cutting ammunition stocks, cutting exercise time. You can cut all the back office functions because you want to keep everything in the shop window. And that, as we've said several times on the programme, is what we've got. We've got a military that looks pretty good in the shop window, but that's all there is. There's nothing else behind it, or there's not enough behind it. And so, yes, it's very frustrating to the public to feel that the MOD absorbs more and more cash and nothing much changes because it's got a lot of ground to make up.
Well, there are a number of pressure points near and far on the government over defence spending, not just the demands from the new commander-in-chief of our biggest ally, or the two Baltic states that are saying they'll meet his target. At home, it's not only opposition politicians, a number of Labour MPs have gently upped the ante as they wait for the defence review and a timeline on increased defence spending. This week, the North Durham MP, Luke Akehurst, said there are many Labour MPs who understand the urgent priority to ensure our armed forces are re-equipped, larger and adequately funded, adding that the scale of the threats the UK faces means 2.5% needs to be the start of the conversation.
I think it's always got to be an absolute top priority for government to ensure that the armed forces that we put into the field have the best possible equipment and are there in large enough numbers to make a meaningful contribution and to stand a chance in a confrontation against whoever the enemy of the day is. And at the moment, that's back to being Russia. And it's also an absolute priority that we're capable of defending the UK homeland. But that's kind of easy for me to say because I'm an MP that takes a particular interest in defence. This is my the issue that I specialise in and that I want to push. And I would assume that the ministers in the Ministry of Defence are pushing for as much funding as they can get as fast as they can get it. But the government as a whole has to think about a wider envelope of priorities, and there's lots and lots of other public spending things that people would rightly be shouting a lot for. So one of the reasons I've been quoted talking about 2.5% of GDP as the start of the conversation is that I want to put on the record that there are people on the government benches that want faster, stronger movement on this. I think that's politically important that there's people on the Labour side of the House of Commons that are making some polite political noise. Yeah, it's within our own party. It's ministers from our own party, but I certainly want to push them to move as fast as possible.
And of course, the Chancellor's priority is growth. Can it wait for that?
Well, the two are interlinked because if we had better economic growth, then our GDP would be higher. And 2.5% of a higher GDP means more kit, more troops being recruited and trained. So the two are not in conflict with each other. And also, I think it's wrong to think of defence spending just as a cost. Actually, equipment procurement, if you do it in a smart way, can be a big driver of economic growth.
So look, when you said that 2.5% of GDP should be just the start of the conversation, is that what you're alluding to? It's not necessarily about percentages, and therefore it's the wider picture and how the money's spent and efficiency. Well, or are you in agreement with perhaps Donald Trump that 5% is really the target it should be?
I think sadly 5% isn't really where the debate is at in the UK yet. I mean, pressure from our largest ally, who have a new president who has very strong views about how much other NATO states should be spending, will probably help shift that debate. But I think we shouldn't get carried away. We've got to get to the 2.5, and then certainly I would want us to go further than that, and I want us to hit 2.5 as quickly as we can. I mean, we know the historical figures from what we were spending during the Cold War and immediately after it was more 4.5%, but we're nowhere near getting back to that at the moment. So we need to be a bit realistic.
And it's, of course, it's also what you want the armed forces to be able to do.
Yeah.
Where do you think the money should be spent when it comes?
So I think that I don't want to prejudge the Strategic Defence Review, but my sense is that the SDR isn't going to be able to deliver a massive uptick for all three services. It's probably going to have to make some tough choices about, do we make a very strong land contribution, or do we assume that Poland and other European armies are going to make the more substantial land contribution and we focus on maritime and air. Everyone getting everything that they want is probably not an option.
I know that you don't want to preempt the findings of the Defence Review, but you must have, Luke, some idea of where you think the gaps are.
Well, I think the gaps, a lot of them are about the number of platforms that we have, sheer kind of mass for any of the armed forces. So, in terms of whether it's escorts in the Navy, or just the airframes that the RAF has, or whether we can field mass of armored vehicles, we don't have the numbers to cope with attrition in a time of warfare. And the same goes just for munitions.
And one of the areas you have raised concern about is the UK's defences, or lack of, against missiles. What do you want done about that, and how much do you think it would cost?
So again, I don't think we can have everything, sadly. So yeah, the ideal solution, if you look at Israel is the model of a country that's had to deal with this. So they have, I think, if my memory is correct, three different layers of missile defence, missiles that hit other missiles, from Iron Dome, which we don't need. Although people use the phrase Iron Dome, that's not the kind of threat that the UK faces. That's for dealing with very short-range missiles and mortars and stuff. And then they have David's Sling and Arrow, I think, is the third one, that deal with different range missiles. And then they would, the layer that's further out, actually the RAF was involved in alongside the Israelis and the Americans, which was using aircraft to shoot down slower moving drones and cruise missiles. We can't possibly jump from virtually nothing to that. So we have some very technically impressive air defense assets, notably the missiles that the Type 45 destroyer carries, but we don't have enough sets of any of those things, whether they're ground-based or on ships, to protect all the potential targets in the UK. So we've got to start re-equipping with additional sets of anti-missile defence. But while we're building that up, we've got to make some very tough decisions about which are the priority targets, the key bits of critical national infrastructure, or even population centres that are the priority for defending.
And you've said many Labour MPs understand the urgent priority to ensure our armed forces are re-equipped, larger and adequately funded. The Defence Secretary promises a timeline to 2.5% in the spring.
Yep.
What will you and your colleagues do if you think that timeline is too long?
Well, I think there are lots of ways in which members of Parliament can can keep putting pressure. So I don't think we should just accept a commitment for 2.5% and a firm timeline, that's going to be welcome. So we're on 2.3 now. So 2.5 is at any speed is good movement, particularly given all the competing pressures there are, and the 2.9 billion that the MOD got in the budget was really good news. But all of us that care about this, we can put pressure publicly, but we can also put pressure privately, and we can keep highlighting the areas that need additional spending. I don't think that that's unfair, and you know, everyone that's got any other political priority that they think the government should be spending on, whether it's things in their constituency or other public services, I mean, it's like, you know, I'm not a monomaniac MP that only cares about defence. There's loads of things I would like, you know, there's schools that are crumbling in my constituency that I would like repaired, there's infrastructure projects that I would like as well, so we're all subject to all those conflicts. But I don't think we should be ashamed at all about keep pushing for this to be a key priority, and to get a mindset going in the Treasury that this is not wasted money. This is saving money down the track, because it stops far worse. You know, if you deter properly, we might never hope that the purpose of having really well-equipped armed forces is that you deter enemies, whether that's Russia or anyone else, from ever actually starting a war, and you save a lot more money and a lot more lives that way. And as I said, I also think that the investment in it on the equipment side of stuff will help with economic growth, particularly in the regions.
Luke Akehurst, I look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I've enjoyed speaking to you. Thanks.
Mike, he's being very measured there, but it is a challenge, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister. Will it have any impact when they're struggling to balance the books?
Well, yeah, I think he was reflecting that fairly faithfully. I mean, as a member of the governing party, it's clear what his own views are, and he is trying to balance lots of different things. But he's absolutely right. Ultimately, this decision will come down to number 10 and the Treasury. And all defence reviews, all decisions on defence, when they get difficult, end up usually at a weekend in Chequers, when it comes down to what does the Prime Minister and his or her staff think, and what does the Treasury and the Chancellor and his or her staff think, as opposed to anybody else, and the Minister of Defence and the Foreign Secretary and so on. A relatively small group of people will have to take some really big decisions. Now, that's always the case when we reach these decision points in defence spending, but I can't think in my career of a bigger crossroads than the one that we're facing this year. If I look back over the last 20 or 30 years, I can't see a bigger problem or a more consequential decision that number 10 and the Treasury will have to face sometime in the next 3 or 4 months. So it's a big moment for British defence for all the reasons that Luke Akehurst set out rather well, I thought.
And ministers have had to deny reports that a timeline for more defence spending could be delayed until the autumn. They insist that and the defence review will come in the spring. Are you hearing anything on your grapevines about the timing?
Not specifically, no. I mean, we think that the review, I mean, I think there's still some drafting going on, as is always the case, incidentally, towards the end of the process. But we think the review will probably be ready for some sort of decision quite soon, in the next month. And I don't think they would leave it until the autumn. I mean, the argument for leaving it until then is to link it into a full spending review, which, of course, will be very important. But I don't think it can wait that long. And I think the government would suffer quite a lot of political fallout if it looked as if it was sitting on a review, which most of us know is probably finished. So my guess is still that it will come out in the next month or 6 weeks. So we were thinking of mid to late February. Maybe it'll slip now to March. But I'd be surprised if it was held until September, October for a big spending review decision. I think it's just got to be, it's inconvenient, but it's got to be, as it were, worked in with that ongoing Treasury discussion about expenditure for the next 5 years.
And Mike, on that 2%, even the new NATO Secretary General has now said the target isn't enough. And looking at NATO's figures, the UK is falling behind rapidly. In 2021, we were the third largest spender behind Greece and the US in terms of GDP. Now we're ninth behind Poland and Denmark, among others. And that's after we put billions extra in. It's not a competition, but at the same time, we've long prided ourselves on being a leader in NATO. How much is that going to be weighing on the Treasury and the MOD as they battle it out right now?
Well, it certainly weighs on the MOD, I can promise you that. Whether it weighs on the Treasury, we will see. I mean, usually it doesn't, those sort of arguments. And remember, when we compare percentages of GDP, we're talking about other countries with a much smaller GDP than ours. So even though they're spending, you know, 3% and 4% maybe in the case of Poland, it's a smaller GDP, where we've got a big GDP by comparison. But these things matter to our allies. And if it looks as if Britain is taking less of a coordinating leadership, collective role, which is what we've always prided ourselves on in NATO, and which will be even more important in the future if the United States is going to lean away from NATO, which, you know, Trump or not, it's likely to do, then these things are important. And so although we can argue about the reality of what does 2.3, 2.5% create and the cash amount that Britain puts into NATO, as it were, in terms of its armed forces, we can play about with those figures. But the political sense that Britain is not taking NATO as seriously as it pretends, that is very debilitating. And at a time when NATO will need to up its game all round, this is the moment when Britain needs to stay politically astute within NATO. And sometimes it means going for these symbolic figures, even if the reality underlying them is a little bit different.
Well, let's dig more into one of Luke Akehurst's priorities for defence spending. Better defence for the UK against missiles. Mike, if a modern missile were streaking towards the UK mainland right now, what chance would we have of taking it down before it hits us?
Very little. Almost none. We have no we have no defence against ballistic missiles, apart from, as Luke Akers said, the Sea Viper. Now, Sea Viper is on our Type 45 Daring class destroyers. And so if we thought it was likely that ballistic missiles were going to be launched against us, and if we had, you know, one or two of our six Daring class destroyers available, and if they happen to be in the right part of the North Sea or the Channel at the moment, then you've got a chance of bringing down one or two missiles. You know, when you
That's
look
a lot
at
of
what
ifs,
the,
Mike.
Yeah, a lot of ifs. So, but if you look at what the Iranians launched twice against the Israeli homeland with multiple drones and missiles, we have no chance whatsoever of defending against that sort of attack. Now, and as Luke said, I mean, the Sea Viper could be a land-based system. It isn't at the moment, but we've got the right missile, but we just don't have enough of them. And we've got them on our Type 45s, but of the six Type 45s we've got, the last time I looked, we only had three of them available to go to sea, and they're working very hard in the Red Sea and against the Houthis and so on, and with other jobs with NATO. So, you know, we have the technology to do some point defence, but we could not, absolutely not, sustain defence against a even half-determined attack by ballistic missiles.
Well, Iran's attacks against Israel last year showed what is seen as the gold standard of missile defence at work. Donald Trump wants to copy it for the US, and some would like the UK to do the same. Let's bring in Claire Sadler, military technology reporter for BFBS Forces News. Hi, Claire. How feasible is a UK missile defence shield exactly?
Well, I mean, it's going to be highly challenging. Firstly, in terms of costs, we've already spoken about the budgets, technology and implementation. Mike's spoken there about some of the defence capabilities that we do have, but what don't we have? And the UK lacks a dedicated system to intercept medium and long-range ballistic missiles. Mention of the Royal Navy's Type 45 destroyers with those missiles, they can intercept some aerial threats, but they aren't optimised for ballistic missile defence. There are upgrade plans, but again, I think those not due until 2028, I think. So the UK, it just doesn't have an equivalent like the US does, the THAAD system, which are designed to counter ballistic missiles in the mid-course phase. So a lot of work to be done.
So how might a UK missile defence shield work?
Well, it would have to be a multi-layered approach, similar to that of Israel or the US, but tailored to our geography and the threats against us. So there are a number of elements that we'd need. There's the early warning and tracking. So using systems like the Wedgetail aircraft that we have, ground-based radar stations and space-based assets to detect and track those incoming threats. In relation to short-range defence, systems like CAM, we'd need upgrades to land-based air defences to protect key sites from cruise missiles, drones and aircraft. Then medium-range defence, again, the UK doesn't have a system like Patriot in the US, which could be bought in to deal with threats like Russian intermediate-range ballistic missiles. It gets more tricky when you go further along. So long-range missile defence, I mean, interceptors are needed to be deployed on ships or land-based sites. They would provide a layer of protection against longer-range threats. And then when you get to the hypersonic defence, well, that's the hardest challenge of all. Defences are going to need to focus on advanced tracking, high-speed interceptors and possibly space-based sensors as well to detect and engage hypersonic glide vehicles.
Yeah, and in that light, how effective could it be?
Well, hypersonic missiles, defending against those are really tricky because of their speed, their manoeuvrability and their unpredictable flight paths. So current UK defences just aren't designed to stop those. Speaking to experts, what they say is that probably the best approach for the UK is going to be disrupting enemy missile systems before they fire. Mm. And also electronic warfare, so jamming or misleading guidance systems, and also hypersonic interceptors. But those are still in development. So it's, you know, it could be effective, but we need all this stuff.
Mike, Iron Dome is the Israeli shield everyone's ever heard of already, but actually that's just one of several layers depending on what's incoming.
Yeah, I mean, Iron Dome has got, in general, a number of systems. It's got three layers, really. The top layer is Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 and Patriot. And they were going to retire the Patriot batteries because the Arrow 3 was an improvement, but they've kept the Patriot battery now. So they do the high-level stuff. And then they've got this one for medium and longer range called David Sling, which is able to intercept missiles and certainly drones and aircraft coming from a longer way out. Sometimes they call it the magic wand, but David Sling is the general name. And then the short range is the Iron Dome itself, and that's a really clever system. It's very fast, very short, and it can intercept artillery shells incoming, which is a sort of a very high specification. So although people call it the Iron Dome system, Iron Dome is only the short range bit of it, which is in some ways the cleverest part of it. So it's a three-layered system. But remember, too, I did some work on this a while ago for a different network. And, I mean, Israel has about 8,000 square miles to cover, right? So it's able to give itself a pretty good system across 8,000 square miles. Mm. Britain is 94,000 square miles. We are 12 times bigger. And the United States is 3.7 million square miles. That's like 450 times bigger than Israel. Point is, Israel is a small country, so yes, yeah, you can defend 8,000 square miles with a very expensive system, which turns out not to be 100% effective. It's 90-something percent effective from these Iranian attacks, the two big attacks that occurred last year. So when people talk about the Israeli example, just think about the differences in size and what you can do.
Yeah.
The reality is, if you have some sort of, let's call it an Iron Dome system, you can only achieve point defence. You can defend some sites or maybe a city. So you've got some pretty hard choices. Which are the sites you would defend? Critical national infrastructure? Or would you defend one or two British cities? Now, that's feasible, very expensive, but feasible. But the idea of having an Israeli-style defence system is just not possible because of the sheer size of territories that we're talking about.
Yeah, thanks for putting that into perspective. And Mike, Claire mentioned that idea of disrupting any attack at source. Have you got any idea where this sits in terms of the defence system in the list of priorities for the UK?
Oh, no, that is quite a high priority, I think, in future thinking. Now, how expensive it will be and how much of it we'll be able to do, we don't know. But it will depend on some space-based systems, some advances in electronic warfare, and the ability, as it were, not necessarily to hit incoming missiles, kinetic energy by hitting a missile with a missile, but actually, as Claire said, finding ways to disrupt them and create a sort of an electronic iron dome over some areas. Again, you've still got the same problem that you can only really achieve point defence. But the essence, in a way, as Claire said, is to be able to stop missiles getting on their way, and that implies having an offensive capability where it's possible, and this is where it gets politically very difficult, it's possible to attack sites before they launch. But that's a get your retaliation in first philosophy, which is politically very fraught.
And how about dealing with all of this at a NATO level?
That's very important, because together the NATO allies can put much more into the field, obviously, than Britain can on its own. And when you look at the geographical advantages to having some systems sited in the Baltics, in Poland and so on, which also serve to defend us, then collectively much more is possible. But everyone in NATO is going to have to spend quite a lot more on all of the sorts of systems that we've talked about. But getting the balance right between, let's call it, the electronic version and the kinetic version, that's still not really been worked through, in my understanding. And that's still a consideration for, as it were, future warfare.
So, Claire, the thinking has to be done. What about the practical questions of the cost? How long could it take to implement this kind of thing?
That's the sort of billion-dollar question, really, isn't it? I mean, it's significant financial investment. You need technological advancements, and you've got to integrate it, as you were just talking about there, with allied systems. So it's going to be costly. I noticed that Luke Akehurst didn't quite answer the question about how much earlier, but billions of pounds, tens of billions, probably. How long? Well, if it's a matter of upgrading what we've got, that can be done in the near future. But actually, to bring in a full-scale sort of system capable of countering hypersonic missiles, that's surely got to be, you know, a decade or more away.
And Mike, your thoughts?
Yeah, it comes back to an old balance, really, that it is cheaper to deter than to defend. If you can deter the use of something against you or deter the war that you fear, then that's much, much cheaper than having to fight it. So to deter an attack on territory is much cheaper than having to liberate territory. And the same goes for the air defence system as well. If you have the right sort of systems that you can deter somebody from even trying it in the first place, that's much, much cheaper than trying to defend yourself when they've decided that you are open and vulnerable and therefore have a go with missiles or whatever it might be to take down either your homeland or even your deployed forces abroad. So deterrence is always cheaper than defence, but that, of course, becomes a difficult policy issue, and it's a difficult philosophical issue when we think about warfare.
I think we might be talking about this again. Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, final big question this week, what's in a name? It seems quite a lot when it comes to Royal Navy vessels, given some of the reactions to the submarine HMS Agincourt being renamed as HMS Achilles, even before she's launched. Some newspapers say the decision was taken by the King himself. Some believe it's woke nonsense, including former Conservative Defence Secretary Grant Shapps. Except, we're told, the Royal Navy-led process began more than a year ago when Mr Shapps was Defence Secretary. So what did happen? We gave Mr Shapps a call and asked him.
Yeah, the question was put to me whilst I was Defence Secretary, and I, you know, quite literally sunk the idea. I said, not on your Nelly, I'm not having that. I mean, we are talking about, you know, an event from 600 years ago, the idea that the French are in the remotest bit offended about it in the current day is really genuinely pathetic. They don't care. Somebody in our Foreign Office cares. They're busily and I think inappropriately saying, oh, it's the King who wants it. As I wrote on my note at the time, if the King's genuinely interested in this, I'm sure he'll talk to me about it. He never did. And I do not believe that it was anything other than probably folks in the Foreign Office wanting to do a bit of what the Foreign Office do best on occasion, which is to be overly sensitive on behalf of our friends and partners. It's not necessary. It denies a lot of our history. And I don't just mean what happened in, I think, 1415. I actually mean the famous vessels that have held the name Agincourt since.
So that is Grant Shapps' take on it all, Mike, to coin a phrase, recollections may vary.
Yes, I don't know why he's blaming the Foreign Office, because they have nothing to do with it, because the process doesn't go anywhere near the Foreign Office normally, unless he's saying that the Foreign Office influenced Buckingham Palace's view and the King's view. But I mean, when I first read this story, I thought, I bet this is, you know, if there has been a change, I bet it's come from the top, because it's the sort of thing that King Charles might think, and it's his privilege to do that. I mean, that, you know, the clue is in the name, HMS, His Majesty's Ship. And by the time the name goes to His Majesty, then two things. One is that he has a preference, and His Majesty may express a preference. And two, when His Majesty has spoken on it, the name cannot be changed. That's one of the conventions, that when the monarch has agreed a name, nobody can change it after that. So it seems to me entirely likely that Buckingham Palace thought about this, and His Majesty thought about it, and thought, if there's a choice, let's go for the Achille rather than the Agincourt.
So if once the king's decided it can't be changed, does it really come down to his choice, the king's choice?
It may do, yes. I mean, the way this works is there's a committee. It's called the Badges, the Names and Badges Committee, and I think it's a rather charming sort of committee. And a number of different groups sit on this committee, including people from the Historical Association, and so on. There's a lot of heritage goes into it, so they choose a name according to the class of ship. And then it goes to the Navy Board, which is really, you know, goes to the First Sea Lord and the Navy Board, and they look at it. They then send it to the Secretary of State, not to the Foreign Office. The Foreign Office has nothing to do with this. And the Secretary of State approves it or expresses a view, and then it goes to the palace. And the monarch will normally say yes, after which it is fixed. But if the monarch has a preference, then that, of course, will be taken into account. And if they want to use a name that is the monarch, like Queen Elizabeth, the aircraft carrier, of course they consult the palace before they even put the name to them. You know, would Her Majesty be agreeable to the aircraft carrier being named the Queen Elizabeth? I mean, that's, you know, standard protocol. So I think the way the system works is pretty efficient, and it's no big deal, to be honest, that they, you know, one name was touted, another name is more acceptable to the monarch. Job done, finished.
What types of names are chosen?
Well, the names represent the class of ship, usually. So at the moment, say, our Type 23s, the frigates with the workhorses, they're the Duke class. So we've got like the Argyle or the Lancaster or the Richmond, they're all Dukes. The Type 26s, when they come along, they'll be the city class. And the first one, I think, is going to be HMS Glasgow. So they're named after big cities. And then our Type 45s, the destroyers that we talked about, the air defence destroyers, they're sort of abstract nouns. So they're the daring class. And they all begin with D. Daring is the first ship is always the name of the class. So the first one is Daring. And then we've got, you know, the Duncan, the Dauntless, the Dragon, the Diamond. I mean, if only they were all at sea at once, it'd be quite impressive, but they never are. And so you've got different classes of ships, and then there are types of ship which are the mine countermeasure vessels. So things like the Chillingfold or the Middleton, the Bangor is a more sophisticated mine countermeasure vessel. So when you see the name, you normally get a sense of what class of ship we're talking about. And sometimes they change the class. If a group of ships is going to be more important or more central, they'll give it slightly more prestigious class of names, like cities or dukes. And, of course, our aircraft carriers are both royal class. So we've got Queen Elizabeth and the Prince of Wales. That's the top of the tree, of course, to name them after monarchs.
And is there a list of no-go names?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's lots of them.
Come on, list us some now.
All right. Well, there was a minesweeper called the Spanker. We won't have that one. There were destroyers. My favourite, there was a destroyer called the Fairy. That's never used. And my favourite is the Frolic.
Yeah, I wonder why.
The Frolic. Yeah, a destroyer called the Frolic. Could you imagine a sailor coming home to his wife saying, I've been on the Frolic for 6 months. And my absolute favourite is the Cockchafer. The Cockchafer. And that, I just kid you not, that was a gunboat. It was a Riverine gunboat launched in 1915. And Cockchafer is the name of a beetle, which interestingly is also called the Doodlebug beetle. So a Cockchafer beetle is a doodlebug. And that has a wartime connotation. But we shouldn't laugh, because the Cockchafer had a very distinguished career, launched in the middle of the First World War. It served in the First World War. in the interwar period, in the Second World War in the Middle East. It was part of the invasion of Sicily in 1943. It had a very distinguished career in both world wars and between the wars. So we shouldn't laugh at the cockchafer, but I think we can guarantee that...
Sorry, I can't stop myself.
No other ships are likely to be given that name. It was called the Insect class. Because it was named after the cockchafer beetle, it was the insect class of river gunboat, which were very popular in the 19th century.
So Mike, just how important is the ship's name to its company?
Oh, it's very important at the time. So the company, the ship's company, they take pride in their name and the ship's name. The difference between now and 50 or 60 years ago is because the Navy is so small, that company will only be with the ship for one tour of duty or one trip, as it were. And then they're broken up. They go to their shore jobs. They're double-hatted. And they'll end up at a different ship. In the old days, I mean, the days of my father and grandfather, particularly my grandfather in the Navy, they would be with one ship for several years, not just for one trip, as it were, because they were that ship's company. But that was in a Navy that had more ships and a lot more sailors. So their identification with it was very strong indeed. It's rather less so these days, I think.
And sailors don't always treat other ships' names with quite the same respect and reverence as their own, though, do they?
No. All ships have their stories. One of the famous ones, the two great battleships of the Second World War, was the Rodney and the Nelson, and they were sister ships. And, of course, their respective crews, who were with them for quite a long time, had a lot of rivalry. When they went past each other in Portsmouth, one was alongside and the other one went past, the sailors would all line up. And which way round was it now? Yeah, it was the Rodney were all known as potato peelers, and the Nelson's crew threw potatoes at them. The Nelson's crew were all called, I have to say, sheep shaggers. And the Rodney's crew would all go bah, bah, bah as they went past.
Can I just say, let Mike off the hook. It's my bad if anyone is offended by that story in any way whatsoever. We wanted him to tell that story, and Mike, you did it so well. Thank you so much. That is all we have time for. Thanks to Mike and all of our guests this week. And Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with, no doubt, some very interesting anecdotes from Mike with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.